You love podcasts, the stories, the laughs, the unexpected turns. But when this episode ends, the silence starts. Not anymore. Audiobooks.com turns that silence into your next great adventure. With over 450,000 titles, from bestsellers to hidden gems, your love for listening just found its new best friend. And because you already know the joy of audio, we're giving you 3 free audiobooks to start your journey. Imagine your favorite podcast, now with unlimited episodes. That's audiobooks.com. Keep the story going. Sign up for your free trial at audiobooks.com/podcastfree today. Because for podcast lovers like you, the end of an episode is just the beginning. That's audiobooks.com/podcastfree.
News, science, the unexplained, space and the cosmos, exploring our past, our future, and the mysteries of our universe. Taking a critical look at reality and a journey to the edges of human understanding. The future is now. This is Micah Hanks.
From the high mountains of Appalachia in a bunker below ground, welcome one and all, it is the Micah Hanks Program. Glad once again to be getting behind the microphone, getting into gear, looking ahead, and of course going in pursuit of the enigmatic like we do every week right here on the UnX Radio Network, and of course listen on demand via podcasting apps in pockets all around the globe. And actually, although we are looking ahead, we're also going to be taking a look back at what happened on Tuesday. Historic UAP hearings. Indeed, in fact, we'll be hearing a little bit from those who were in participation. We'll be getting some views in recent days that have been offered about the historic importance of this, what it means for the military, what it means for science, and of course also a bit of news of the anomalous variety. There's been a lot of talk, for instance, about things showing up in recent photographs on the Red Planet. That's right. I mean, it's just a crazy world, ladies and gentlemen. And in fact, if we're talking about Mars, worlds applies, right? A crazy solar system. So lots to get into this week. First and foremost, as always, I hope you guys are doing great out there. Hope you had a really stellar weekend. Whether or not you're one of our many backyard astronomers out there, you know I am. And although last night it wasn't clear enough for me to be able to see the night sky and the stellar displays that I enjoy so much about Appalachian living, especially in the warmer weather months, I was treated to almost cinematic lightning storm off in the distance. And one of the unique things about living here in the mountains, I guess it kind of has to do with the lay of the land, you know, the shape of the landscape. In such circumstances, a lightning storm can be off at a fair distance, not that far away. I mean, certainly close enough to light everything up, but you don't hear any thunder or anything associated with it. So it's a perfectly silent, beautiful evening. Frogs singing, crickets chirping, and it looks like the gods are doing battle in the sky a short distance from my house. I mean, lightning literally lighting up the landscape with such frequency that it almost looked like daylight for extended stretches well after midnight last night. So it was really beautiful. I just love nature. I don't know. Maybe you guys don't geek out about those kinds of things quite as much as I do. But of course, in the back of my mind, anytime I'm observing a natural display like that, usually the kinds of things that are going through my mind are, rather than, wow, that's really pretty, I'm thinking to myself, you know, if I pay close attention, I might be treated to a rare occurrence. Because from time to time, there are those manifestations of what is known as ball lightning. I would probably guess that if I'm watching a lightning storm and I see a self-contained luminous orb, roughly the same color as the lightning I'm seeing off in the distance, I'd probably think, oh, okay, rather than UFO, that's probably ball lightning. The problem, though, with ball lightning, as many who have tried to study it will know, is that its appearances are very rare. The occurrences are increasingly fleeting, usually just a few seconds. And yet, when you have locations like Brown Mountain, North Carolina, which I've talked about a lot on this show over the years because I've spent a lot of time down there doing my own personal research, those luminous manifestations, whatever they are, whatever happens down there at Brown Mountain, doesn't necessarily happen coinciding with lightning storms. And this is something that's caused some researchers to look at another alternative explanation, but nonetheless a natural one that might help account for what we are seeing. And that theory, in short, involves earthquake lights. Kind of fascinating. Okay, if we don't have lightning storms and electrical potential in the atmosphere that can be conducive to the formation of these UFO-like glowing orbs that spin around and people see flying through the air, what else might account for that? And indeed, some geologists think that seismic pressure built up around fault zones, usually preceding an earthquake, but sometimes also after one, but that around the time of seismic events, these luminous displays can occur. And in fact, there has been footage of earthquake lights kind of appearing in colorful rainbow-like shafts extending up from the ground. That's been filmed plenty of times over the years. But these globular forms, these balls of lightning that sometimes appear, they've been photographed there at Brown Mountain and other locations over the years, and also coinciding with seismic events. You know, when we talked with Dave Beatty in recent days about his investigation into the USS Ronald Reagan incident and this plasma-like glowing light that had hovered over the ship that night that so many Navy personnel saw, this is one of the angles that Dave explored. Is it possible that there might be a natural explanation for this? The problem, of course, though, being that at sea, one wouldn't expect, based on what's in the scientific literature, to be seeing earthquake lights, but maybe we can't rule that out. In any case, for me, anytime we've got UFO-like phenomena that occur and appear to do so coinciding with other natural phenomena, we should really put our attention toward that. In fact, while scientists are saying we've got to start studying these UAP, we've got to get in there, start doing the research, go find these things, you know, I would say, before you go out there and just aim your telescopes and your cameras and your FLIR systems at the sky and say, let's just start filming and hope something shows up, why don't we go out there and we study these anomalous lights at these locations where people have said that for sometimes decades, sometimes even longer, that these things recur, that they tend to appear more frequently there than at other locations. I mean, I'd find it pretty hard to believe that this is a good explanation for something like the so-called Tic Tac, right, in 2004. Or maybe even cases like that object that was seen, or that light, above the USS Ronald Reagan. Sure, but these are anomalous aerial phenomena. They seem to recur more frequently at certain locations. Maybe if we put our emphasis on studying those areas first and try to get to the bottom of what the mechanism is behind those lights, we will have a better understanding in sum total of the varieties of different circumstances that can give rise to anomalous phenomena in our skies. The more we know, the more data we are equipped with, the better off we will be. Maybe in the days ahead, in fact, when I visit the Scientific Coalition for UAP Studies conference that they are holding down in Huntsville, Alabama, maybe I'll bring that up with some of the members of the UAPX team who are going to be in attendance there. And by the way, on that note, we might as well get into some news related to that. In recent days, Northeast Public Radio WAMC's Ray Graff actually sat down with one of those team members and also, of course, a member of the Scientific Coalition for UAP Studies. That was Dr. Kevin Knuth, and he asked him a question that struck me as interesting. And that had to do with public research conducted by scientific groups like UAPX or the SCU versus the kind of military studies often conducted initially in secret, but of course even after they become public knowledge, we still don't see a lot of the data from those programs. Yeah, Ray asked Dr. Knuth his thoughts about this, comparing UAPX to ATIP, as you're about to hear in the following audio soundbite.
Do you think that privately funded research like this, presumably, although I don't know where UAPX gets its money, do you think that's a better bet than ATIP?
Oh, that's a good question. Well, ATIP was a secret program, so they basically would operate by reading in researchers into their program, and so you'd have to have clearance, and you'd have to work, you know, be read into the program, and then asked to join.
Right.
So that's a very different venture.
But I mean, scientists, and frankly, there have been more than a few scientists who have been somewhat cast aside or ostracized to some extent for even showing interest in this.
Right.
Scientists try to do science. There's not a shortage of cuckoos. I've followed UFOs 50 years, and there are many wonderful people and very smart people, but there are also those on the fringe. Are you concerned about you, physicist, Dr. Kevin Knuth losing a little prestige from this.
Always concerned about that. And there are times when we filmed the movie, my colleague Matthew would say to me, goes, Kevin, you have to speak up more in this movie. you have to talk more. And at one point I told him, I said, I'm afraid to talk more. I'm afraid of how this is going to be construed by the, you know, by the scientific community when it finally comes out. And so, yeah, I was certainly conscious of that and cognizant of that.
That again, Dr. Kevin Knuth, a member of the Scientific Coalition for UAP Studies. Yes, he appears also alongside the UAPX team in that recent film, Terror in the Sky, which, by the way, I finally watched. Yes, I finally watched the film. I have to say, any group who's going to try and collect data about UAP, and a civilian group at that, so that they can publicly release that information, and it can thereafter be studied by all, and we can maybe learn something from it, you know, I wholeheartedly support those efforts. I had my, let's call it editorial and stylistic issues with the way the film was made. I won't say anything more about that. I'll just let you guys watch it. My pal Chrissy Newton, by the way, who will be joining me down at the SCU event also in the days ahead. She'll also be with me out there in Vernal, Utah at the UFO Disclosure Symposium. You'll see us both there manning the table for the debrief.org at that event. And of course, thereafter at the SCU, merely attending and watching with rapt attention as we try to unravel the mysteries of UAP and how science can be applied to them. But yes, Dr. Knuth is going to be there, as I understand. I look forward to talking to him. He travels a lot. He stays really busy. I've invited him to be on this show. We almost had a discussion lined up, and then he had a last-minute change of schedule. We had to punt, and that was right before I went to Brazil, and so we just haven't realigned our schedules. We'll definitely have Dr. Knuth on the program at some point, because I'd like to talk to him about what he was describing in that audio soundbite we just heard, where he's talking with Ray Graff and saying, not only is civilian scientific research regarding UAP very different from what the government is doing, and we'll talk about all of that here in a moment after we get into the discussion about these congressional hearings from this week, but he's also saying that, you know, he's constantly worried as a scientist about how he will be portrayed, what people will think of him. And when we're talking about trying to collect data about UAP, we have to acknowledge it isn't always easy. There are a lot of hindrances to the furtherance of research. A few that Kevin were talking about there, in addition to being a traditional scientist, and keep in mind, he has an interest in UAP and he's putting a lot of time, effort, and energy into that, but that's by no means the sole focus of Dr. Knuth's work as a scientist. You know, if you go and you look at the journal that I believe he is the editor of and the kinds of papers he has co-authored over the years, some have had to do with UAP, but that's not the sum total of his body of work by any means. And so naturally, I've got to sympathize with a guy like Kevin Knuth, who is, you know, a respected scientist in his own field, but who also is interested in something that has long been castigated, a topic that's been relegated to the fringe. And something else, by the way, that Ray Graff points out in that audio soundbite, you know, there are lots of respectable people, great minds, who are engaging with this subject. But then, of course, there are the crazies, the loonies who have looked at this for long periods and who've kind of already made up their minds about what it may be. Now, for my own part, I try to be a personable person, and I like some of those old guard UFO researchers who've done great research, but, you know, their minds have essentially been made up for a long time. It's aliens or nothing, right? I don't necessarily proceed with that supposition about what UAP represent. I like to try and resist the temptation of, well, what else could they be, right? We're either talking about spaceships being piloted by alien greys, or we're talking about nothing at all. Ball lightning? Sorry, it doesn't interest me. I get it, there are some UFO researchers who essentially feel that way, but I'm not one of them. I'm very interested in ball lightning, which I guess is why I sit up late at night and watch lightning storms. I'm very interested in trying to understand what may cause things like ball lightning and earthquake lights. I'm also interested in how understanding those phenomena might have applications that could help us unravel aspects of UAP behavior when we are talking about objects that appear to be intelligently controlled and perhaps even of a manufactured origin of some kind. But you know, in the days ahead when we head out there to Utah, I'm going to be in an event where I hope to try and represent that side of this discussion. And I realize there are going to be some other researchers who are probably of very similar mind. Avi Loeb is going to be joining us remotely and participating in a panel discussion I'll be hosting with a group of scientists. But I fully realize there are going to be some of the old guard UFO types and a few of the fringe crazies who will be there also. And that does complicate the dynamic because, you know, for those who want to try and represent a serious scientific approach to this topic, you know, many would argue that mixing and intermingling with the fringe crazies doesn't necessarily help the cause. I mean, people were actually saying as much on Twitter over the weekend after Tim McMillan and I held a Twitter Spaces where we were primarily talking about both the congressional hearings, but also the history behind that and historical parallels between modern research and what's happened in decades past with programs like Project Blue Book. You know, we're trying to have a serious, scientifically and historically informed discussion. And people are, of course, coming out of the woodwork and saying, yeah, but, you know, unless we get this entirely out of the hands of the fringe types and into the hands of the scientists, you know, we'll never make any progress. So I've got to respect people like Kevin Knuth saying, you know, I constantly worry about, you know, what I'm saying, how much I'm saying, whether I've already said too much, and how what I say or where I appear might be conveyed, even misconstrued by some, in terms of the broader scientific efforts to try and get to the bottom of UAP. It's complex. I have to say, I think also that the Scientific Coalition for UAP Studies, with their forthcoming event down there in Huntsville, have maybe done the best job of anybody at trying to kind of corral the UAP researchers who are really serious about this, not excluding those who have been involved for decades, but really trying to narrow the focus towards science. I don't think any effort to do that is perfect yet. They're definitely doing the best job. And last I heard, by the way, that event that they'll be holding is almost sold out. But you can, of course, buy the streaming package and you can watch the entire event from the comfort of your home. You can learn all about that at explorescu.org if you're interested in checking out what they have to offer. A few more news stories that have been happening in recent days. You know, after our conversation with Dave Beatty the other day, I found this one interesting. NPR reporting that there's been a surge in Navy deserters, which they, of course, characterize as potentially a bigger problem for the military. Why all of these deserters? As they note here, back in 2021, there were 157 sailors who illegally fled the U.S. Navy. And that, mind you, more than double the number who deserted back in 2019. They say although all but eight of them eventually did return to their units, a military legal expert says that the dramatic increase in desertions may be a sign of a bigger issue. According to Lieutenant Commander Devin Arneson, she said that she can't speculate about the increase in Navy desertions or why a sailor would choose desertion. That essentially an unauthorized absence in which a military member has no intention of returning, although as we heard, some, actually a lot of them, eventually do. But you've also got to keep in mind, I mean, they can be severely penalized for this. I mean, they may lose their benefits from being in the armed services. They may actually see time in jail, let alone a dishonorable discharge from service. But according to one former JAG officer, they say, with 11 years of military justice experience, they say that the issue underscores a harsh reality for some service members who find themselves seemingly stuck in a line of work that they dislike and that's tied to a multi-year contract. You know, I'm wondering, looking at this, is this actually evidence of this growing sociological trend we see in society these days, the big walkout? There are different names for it, but people essentially just saying, you know, I am tired of my job. I don't receive enough pay. I'm unhappy with my employment for various other reasons. I quit. It's harder to do that when you're a member of, for instance, the U.S. Navy or other branches of the military, considering some of those penalties I mentioned, but it's still happening. So yeah, maybe this is a broader problem. Maybe it's not one that is exclusive only to the military either. Speaking of problems, by the way, some of you may have also seen recently that U.S. President Biden has warned that everyone should be concerned about monkeypox. Great. Please tell me we haven't got another infectious disease to be worried about. And actually, there may be some good news, but here's what Joe Biden said on Sunday about this. He said, they haven't told me the level of exposure yet, but he characterized monkeypox as being something that everyone should be concerned about. He said this before boarding Air Force One as he was on his way from South Korea to Japan during recent travels. According to USA Today, Biden was quoted saying, we're working on it hard to figure out what we do and what vaccine, if any, might be available for it. Now, based on those talking points and that essentially commanding the headlines over the weekend after he said them, you know, many would look at this and say, oh boy, brace yourselves. We already know what happens when we have a pandemic
sweep the globe. And although they say that nearly a dozen countries are now investigating what they've called atypical outbreaks of monkeypox, a disease they say that comes from the same family of viruses as smallpox and is typically found in Central and West Africa, let's look at a few of the other facts. Right now, for instance, the United States only has 2 recorded cases. That's right, 2 in Massachusetts and New York City. They also note that human-to-human transmission is actually considered very uncommon. Doesn't happen all that often, although they do note that the highest risk people are those who interact very closely with somebody who has become infected with it, which, according to USA Today, they note is a generally mild disease. So maybe we shouldn't be too alarmed yet. But they also note here that the World Health Organization on Friday said it's stepping up its efforts to understand and combat it. In other words, after what we've all been through, nobody wants to take any chances right now, do they? Another serious warning, though, on the tech side of things was recently issued for Google Gmail users. I use Gmail, many of you out there, most in fact, probably do. And as Gordon Kelly, writing for Forbes, recently noted, Gmail, the world's most popular email service, is also known to be one of the most secure, but unfortunately in recent days, something was pointed out that has some experts concerned. Security researcher Yosef Samuda, apparently in a recent blog post, revealed that Gmail's OAuth authentication code enabled him to exploit vulnerabilities in Facebook and to hijack Facebook accounts when Gmail credentials were used to sign into the service. He said the wider implications of this, of course, are significant. In other words, what they're talking about is, you've probably seen this often when you're signing in to various services online, you'll be either prompted to use an email or to create a password, or sometimes it will say sign in with Gmail. Right? If you're logged into Google and you're logged into your Gmail account, you can log into a lot of other services using those credentials. And so apparently Samuda found that that allows a vulnerability. Probably something we should be concerned about in the days ahead. You don't want to discover one of those back doors when it's a little too late. And then, of course, you've got to deal with all the security problems that could result from that. But speaking of doorways, by the way, and back doors, or what some have called in recent days a dog door, this one was found on Mars by the Curiosity rover, and everybody's been talking about this. I'm sure many of you by now have seen the image in question. It's been all over Twitter, all over the news. I'll have it, of course, linked in the show notes, too, so that you also can see what some have characterized as a dog door in the east cliffs of Gale Crater on the surface of Mars. So what are we looking at? Because naturally, you know where people's minds go when they see something like this. Oh my gosh, there it is. Indisputable proof of an entrance to an alien base on the red planet. We now know. Well, according to the folks at space.com, it seems that geologists would probably have a different take on this. As they note, scientists behind NASA's Curiosity rover, which snapped the pictures earlier this month, said that while the strange door-like feature on Mars provides a fascinating, and they even characterized it as this, quote, a doorway into the ancient past, unquote, they say it is a perfectly natural work, not that of some aliens in hiding. So not really a door, it only happens to look like one. But that doesn't keep everybody out there on social media from speculating, right? Admittedly, there have been some really strange things that appear in photos from Mars. But you've got to keep a number of things in mind here, right? First of all, yes, nature is wonderful. Nature is full of mysterious things. I often try to emphasize that point on these programs each week. And often, the mysterious things in nature can have the appearance of being manufactured, which in fact, tempting though it is to draw those kinds of conclusions, more often than not, that isn't the case. And of course, when you factor in things like pareidolia, the human tendency to spot patterns and see images where, in fact, none appear, I strongly caution people when they think that they see things, especially things that have a technological or manufactured appearance, to be very careful at drawing those conclusions based on a superficial observation alone, because nature, more often than not, can tend to be very surprising. Again, the natural world is fascinating. And I love everything about it, from the mysteries that it affords us from time to time to speculate about and ponder, to the ways that, of course, it can also improve our health and our state of being, even our state of mind. That's certainly been the case during my experience taking Athletic Greens, an all-natural supplement that provides a product that I literally do use every single day. I started taking it because, first of all, Athletic Greens is all natural. You can use it to supplement virtually any kind of diet, any kind of lifestyle. You know, I like to do high protein, lots of fruits and veggies, but I exercise a lot. And so it also gives you that energy kick that you need to really be able to perform the best on the days where you're going to be doing some heavy lifting or getting out there and hitting the trails. Trust me, the Appalachian Mountains are full of beautiful trails fit for hiking and jogging. But if I want to be able to endure on those long treks through the mountains, I've found that my energy's got to be at its absolute peak. And Athletic Greens is a natural vitamin supplement that really helps me achieve that. So I personally take it for those reasons. I take it in the morning before I eat anything. You know, take it on an empty stomach. That's actually how they recommend you do it. You just take one scoop and add it to a cup of water. You stir, you drink, and you go. But I've found that Athletic Greens, or AG1 as they call it, does more than just help me exercise and keep energy levels at their peak. After a long day of work, I also sleep better at night. And the other great thing is that in addition to large packages where you can just take a scoop and add it to water if you're at home, Athletic Greens is also sold in individual pouches, which make it really easy to carry with you when you're traveling all over the place like I tend to do. Again, it's important to choose carefully the kinds of vitamins you take, and with a natural multivitamin with high-quality ingredients like AG1, Athletic Greens is going to provide you that. And as far as a small, what we might call micro habit, but with big benefits, that's what you get from Athletic Greens. It's not hard to just add it to a cup of water and drink a glass every single morning, but you're going to get big long-term effects in terms of supporting your health and immune function from doing so. And plus, when you subscribe to receive Athletic Greens, that subscription they give you comes with a year's supply of vitamin D as well, which at various times of the year is very important to have as a part of your diet, especially when you aren't getting as much sunlight as we do like right now in the summer months. And plus, keep in mind it's affordable. Athletic Greens is going to cost you less than $3 a day. And for that little investment, you're investing in your health. And that's a whole lot cheaper even maybe than your cold brew habit. So, all that said, Athletic Greens is available online. I'm going to tell you where you can find it, because right now it is time to reclaim your health and arm your immune system with convenient daily nutrition. There's no need to take dozens of pills to look out for your health and well-being. You're going to get essentially everything that you need with all of nature's essentials that you need. And remember, to make it easy, Athletic Greens is going to give you that free one-year supply of immune-supporting vitamin D and five of those free travel packs I was talking about with your first purchase. So all you got to do is visit athleticgreens.com/Micah. Again, that's athleticgreens.com/MICAH, my name, Micah. athleticgreens.com/Micah to take ownership over your health and pick up the ultimate daily nutritional insurance. And with that, it's now time for us to shift our attention back to the ever-timely topic of UAP on the other side of this break. Because on Tuesday, we had this historic House panel that discussed the current efforts of the military regarding unidentified aerial objects. We've got a lot to discuss when we return right here on the Micah Hanks Program. A House panel recently convened to speak with military officials about unidentified aerial phenomena. What did they have to say? What have we learned? Welcome back. It is the Micah Hanks Program. Glad as always to be here with all of you as we try to make sense of the madness that unfolds in our world every week. Keep in mind, of course, you can follow my work, this program, and of course all of my efforts over there at MicahHanks.com and on Twitter at MicahHanks. Over the weekend, my cohort Tim McMillan and I decided to do one of these Twitter spaces, which, of course, this was our first one. And so there were some minor technological hurdles. After the fact, I saw people saying, you know, did you record it? We'd like to go back and listen to this. Our intention had just been kind of on Saturday morning to catch up and chat a little and let people listen in if they wanted to. And lo and behold, I'm just getting my microphone configured so I could actually route my broadcast system through the Twitter app on my iPhone. And Tim's inviting me to join, so we get in there, and it starts filling up pretty quickly with listeners. We had a wide range of people involved in the field, which included Ryan Sprague, friend of the program. We had Tom Rogan from the Washington Examiner, Mick West, noted skeptic who's provided his video analysis of some of the Navy footage. We had Graham Rendell, who's a former guest on the program here. I'm sure he'll come back on again because he'll have another research project in the works in the days ahead. My hiking partner and also journalist extraordinaire Brett Tingley was in there. I mean, a lot of people from a lot of different perspectives on the UAP debate joining in and listening to Tim and I chatting about what's been going on in recent days following this congressional hearing. And naturally, there's a lot of interest in this. And there have been a lot of different responses, too, a few of which we'll be getting to here in a moment. But first, I want to kind of focus on setting the stage for what unfolded. Of course, we had this hearing that was held. We had two military expert witnesses, Mr. Bray and Mr. Moultrie. We'll talk more about who they are, what their backgrounds are, and why they were qualified to speak about this in a bit. But they were providing answers to representatives who had some very interesting questions about UAP. And it was pretty evident from the questions that some of the representatives were asking that they were more than just a little up to speed on the history of the UFO subject. Which here again, this kind of parallels something we were talking about in the opening segment. You know, separating the serious scientific effort in modern times from the historical research. A lot of people actually think, you know, if we're going to make any headway with UAP, we can't only just focus on trying to get it out of the hands of the fringe types who attend the conferences and wear the t-shirts and buy all the books and things like that and get it over to the scientists. No, we've also got to make a disconnect between historical research and the modern stuff, because the modern stuff is where the best technology's been employed. It's where military officials have been taking it the most seriously. There's not going to be as much value to studying this historical stuff, and that certainly is the case for non-military source materials. So all the books that have been written by civilian researchers are next to no good. There are many who seem to have that kind of idea when it comes to the modern study of UAP. For my own part, I find that really problematic. I'd like to think that members of the UAP Task Force have not only studied the data that's been collected since 2019, but maybe that they've actually read a book like UFOs in Government by Dr. Michael Swords and Robert Powell, who will be down there at the SCU event in the days ahead, being a founding member of that organization, and somebody who has spent a lot of time working on the history of this subject and trying to present a non-sensational historical account of the military's ongoing studies of UAP throughout the decades. I think it would be very beneficial for people in government to know that. And so, for my part, being one who holds that kind of an opinion, I was very pleased, in some regards, to see some of the representatives during the House panel on Tuesday asking those kinds of questions. They obviously knew a lot about the history of this subject, and had probably read more than many would have expected that they had. But, in contrast to that, Moultrie and Scott Bray often in their responses said, I'm unfamiliar with that. That information isn't in the database currently being looked at by the UAP Task Force. Yeah, their responses essentially were, we aren't familiar with all that historical data. To me, that may represent a problem going forward. If not a serious problem, at very least it could present some limitations in terms of the understanding members of the military who are beginning to look at this will have. But as far as those who've been looking at this right now in the aftermath of these hearings, which many of you out there watched, and we're going to have some notable sound bites and big takeaways that we're going to analyze over the course of the program as well. I first want to turn to a few takes that were offered in recent days, and maybe a logical place to start would be the official statement that was issued from the office of Senator Kirsten Gillibrand of New York. And this is exactly what she said following that open House Intelligence Committee hearing on UAP. According to Gillibrand, we are grateful to the House Intelligence Committee, especially Subcommittee Chairman Carson and Ranking Member Crawford, for hosting today's hearing on unidentified aerial phenomena. Public congressional interest in this issue will contribute toward countering the stigma faced by service members and others in reporting their own encounters with UAP, thereby improving our own data collection to help resolve this national security issue. Gillibrand went on to note that the language we secured in the National Defense Authorization Act, she's referring, of course, to the so-called Gillibrand Amendment, made it clear that the Department of Defense and other agencies must urgently approach this issue in a broad manner and consider all origins of UAP, known or unknown. The level, she says, of bipartisan interest from the National Security Committees in Congress, as well as from the American people, make it clear that the department cannot delay in staffing the NDAA-established office, developing a science plan, and integrating already existing data to properly investigate these phenomena. Our national security demands that the department moves on this issue with haste and maintain transparency with Congress. So that concludes Senator Gillibrand's statement. And of course, a couple of the important takeaways here. I think that, like Senator Gillibrand points out, there is a tremendous level of bipartisan interest in this subject. And that has especially been the case in Washington. That even came up during the hearings the other day. How inspiring to an extent, really, it is to see lawmakers on opposite sides of the political fence who are really meeting in the middle to discuss an issue without bringing so much politics to it. Now, unfortunately, there are some out there, perhaps also on UFO Twitter, who do occasionally try to inject politics into this in various ways. And look, guys, I don't care what your political beliefs are. I mean, I have my own, so I do care to an extent. But when it comes to an issue like this and its national security implications, I have to share Gillibrand's sentiments and those of others who have said, you know, this is a bipartisan issue. Good thing it's been treated as such. And I think that really it's more beneficial in the long run to look at it like that, rather than to try and find ways that we can attack and accuse one another on social media and politicize something that really has been so long deserving of attention. I think that's very important. She also notes, of course, the fact that the NDAA established office and its science plan and integrating already existing data to properly investigate these phenomena, those are some of the points that Gillibrand raised. Again, the DOD had already established its AMSOG, apparently that's how we're supposed to pronounce that, based on what we heard in the hearing the other day, the AOI MSG, or otherwise known as the Airborne Object Identification Management and Synchronization Group. The DOD established it last November and kind of preemptively said, you know, we're only going to be looking at things happening in military airspace, which a lot of people saw as being pretty limited in scope. Well, now the Gillibrand Amendment, which had been proposing before the establishment of the AOI-MSG, it had already been proposing the establishment of a UAP office. And now, as was recently clarified to me by Pentagon spokeswoman Susan Goff, the AMSOG, already having been established, is now going to be essentially expanded and retrofitted to meet the requirements that have been passed by Congress in the Gillibrand Amendment to the NDAA. And so essentially, if you want to see what the AMSOG will be doing, go and read the final language included in that bill when the NDAA passed, you know, the science plan that she's talking about, field investigations, you know, interest in whether or not these events involving UAP occur more frequently at nuclear sites, things like this apparently are all going to be considered. Health effects from those who have had close encounters with UAP. But also note that Gillibrand says integrating already existing data to properly investigate these phenomena. I hope, here again, that that will also include some historical data, some of it collected by the U.S. Air Force during Blue Book, maybe some of it collected elsewhere. For another take, though, now heading over to the media, we also had Julian E. Barnes, who occasionally comments on UAP developments when they relate to Washington over there at the New York Times. As he noted, the highlight of the hearing was a split-second image shot last year through the window of an F-A-18 fighter jet of a spherical object in the distance. The pilot also reported observing an object. It remains unexplained and is an example of how difficult it is to determine what a short clip may show. By the way, anybody who's interested in seeing that video in slightly better resolution than what appears during the hearings, which you can go on YouTube and watch, if you head over to the Debriefs YouTube channel, we've made that available there as well. But as they note, Pentagon officials also played a video and displayed an image shot through night vision lenses that showed glowing green triangles moving through the air. This video, of course, has already been available to the public for quite some time, but they said unequivocally that this footage does not show triangles. This is the so-called spooky bokeh effect. These were just drones that were being filmed, And in fact, it's an artifact of the lens used to produce the imagery that gave them that triangular shape, which I think is significant for a lot of pieces of footage purportedly showing triangular-shaped UFOs that have been obtained through night vision over the years. Certainly worth keeping in mind. As Barnes writes, the hearing was followed by a classified session where the Pentagon officials could candidly discuss the capabilities and limitations of cameras and other sensors used to record these images. Of course, it's more than just images that they are studying. In fact, a lot of sensory data that really doesn't have a visual component, perhaps apart from how it's displayed on a screen, is also being incorporated, if we think about radar and other kinds of sensor systems. As Barnes also noted for the Times, part of the effort going forward, said Ronald S. Moultrie, the Defense Department's Undersecretary for Intelligence, is to make sure that military sensors, the likes of which I'm referencing there, are properly calibrated to record as much information as practical on the unexplained phenomena. Better, higher fidelity data will allow the Pentagon to draw better conclusions about unidentified phenomena. Now, a quick point, by the way, about that video of this little metallic thing. Mick West, by the way, on Twitter was saying it's probably a Mylar balloon. You know, if I had to guess, I would agree with Mick on that. That's really what it seems to most closely resemble. But, and this maybe is where I would differ from Mick West a bit, before I make up my mind about what I think might be in a video like that, I do acknowledge there may also be more sensory data that was collected at the time of that sighting, and that might complicate the balloon theory. And even if that's not the case in that instance, and that is just a Mylar balloon that a jet happened to see in film, I'm of a mind to think that there's probably a lot of sensory data that strongly supports the notion that there are unidentified, unresolved, mysterious objects or craft in our airspace, and the public hasn't had access to that. If we saw that data, we might also conclude similarly, but at least provisionally, that appears to be what the Navy's UAP task force, and of course, when this transitions over to the AIMSOG, based on the data that has been collected on UAP to date, you know, we are withholding any kind of speculation. We are abstaining from judgment. We're just saying these things are unidentified. There are lots of things we're seeing, lots of ways we're collecting data on them. But as far as that video goes, here's my hot take. I betcha that's one of the least interesting videos they have. Why? Because that makes it the most sanitized way that they can give an example of quote-unquote UAP that they can show in an open public hearing. I personally was very surprised that they offered any samples during the open hearing portion at all. But I think that that was done for a couple of reasons. They wanted to meet public demand. They wanted to seem like they're forthcoming with data they're collecting. But they didn't want to show us the good stuff. Look, if they really wanted to show us more convincing videos of UAP, they could have shown the already historically acknowledged Navy UFO videos that everybody's already seen. But again, I think that they probably felt like if we don't show the public something that they haven't already seen, they're going to accuse us of a cover-up. You're showing us stuff we already know about, you know, but how does the military respond when they're like, well, yeah, you already seen some of the best ones we've got, so here's something new. But I'm pretty sure they probably gave us the worst of the new stuff they could show so that they could be both forthcoming and open, but also not give away too much. The downside of that too, though, by the way, is that people see this and they're like, well, great, our Navy task force is studying Mylar balloons. I'm certainly feeling reassured about the military's UAP investigative efforts. So again, the downside is you don't show enough and people start saying, well, then maybe you guys aren't really collecting anything. And again, these were just some of the opinions that were being aired in recent days following this event. Dana Milbank, writing for the Washington Post, noted that at Tuesday's hearing, Representative Mike Gallagher insisted that the Pentagon investigate an incident that, quote, allegedly occurred at Malmstrom Air Force Base, in which 10 of our nuclear ICBMs were rendered inoperable. At the same time, a glowing red orb was observed overhead, unquote. Ronald Moultrie, the Undersecretary of Defense for Intelligence and Security, said that the UAP task force hadn't looked into it, explaining that there are many things out there in the ether that aren't officially brought to our attention. Well, as Dana points out, the congressman neglected to mention the supposed incident took place in 1967. He then pivots over to Gallagher's mention of the Admiral Wilson memo, but instead of following that tangent, you know, here's a question I'd have for Dana Milbank. You know, what's the problem with this incident having occurred in 1967? If indeed UAP appeared over a ICBM storage area and shut down our missile defense systems temporarily, why shouldn't our government officials be looking at that as a historical example of what UAP might and note my emphasis there, might be capable of. If we talk with former servicemen like Robert Salas, who's been here on the program and talked with us about this, if we look at the testimony of many members of the U.S. Air Force and other military bodies who have claimed to have been on hand when these events occurred, I mean, maybe there is something worthy of study here. And again, the Gillibrand Amendment to the NDAA is saying, you know what? We want our investigative body, the AIMSOG or whatever else, to look at this. So, you know, really, what's the problem with that having occurred in 1967? Milbank puts that forward as though that makes it a non-issue. Should we just completely ignore anything that has happened in the historical record with this phenomenon? I don't think so. Let's also get a take from Brian Bender, who wrote over at Politico, who also focused a bit on what Representative Gallagher had to say. As Bender writes, Mike Gallagher says he doesn't believe that a secret cabal of government officials and contractors are hiding a captured alien spaceship, but he wants to make sure so that we can all move on to more serious business. As Bender goes on to note, one of the most eye-popping moments during a House Intelligence Committee hearing on UFOs on Tuesday was when the Wisconsin Republican pressed Pentagon officials on claims that a glowing red orb once shut down nuclear weapons in Montana, and that a recently leaked document revealed that otherworldly vehicles and possibly even extraterrestrial bodies are being kept from government leaders and the public. He says Gallagher was quickly dubbed a hero on hashtag UFO Twitter for having the guts to finally hold national security officials accountable. Others expressed surprise that a sitting congressman was willing to go there, given the lack of corroborating evidence in the public domain and the overall topic's pop culture saturation with science fiction fantasy over fact. Now look, I've already offered my take on the 1967 incident. Yeah, maybe that should be looked into, even by our current military efforts involving UAP. But if you want my take on the Wilson memo and why I have essentially said maybe that's less concerning, and therefore we shouldn't be necessarily spending or wasting time talking about it, if you head over to thedebrief.org, check out this week's Intelligence Brief newsletter, which you'll find right there on the main page. Just look for the article by me, Four Big Takeaways and Surprises That We Learned from This Week's UFO Hearing. I'll give you my take on all of that. And of course, in the show notes this week, we'll also have additional links to stories, including, for instance, an opinion piece that Avi Loeb wrote for The Hill about why he says that pushing the frontiers of science may actually be helped along with government data. He also, of course, is a weekly columnist over there for us over at The Debrief, so if you haven't been following Dr. Loeb's work for us there at thedebrief.org, definitely check that out as well. One more quick one before we go to the break here, though. Along with Avi Loeb emphasizing the science side of what happened on Tuesday, we also had Rizwan Virk, founder of Playlabs at MIT, writing for NBC News. He said that while it's good that Congress is finally taking this subject seriously, the hearing itself didn't do enough to challenge one of the most limiting aspects when it comes to understanding UFOs, seeing them almost entirely as a matter of military concern. He goes on to note some of the points that were made by Representative Carson and others during the hearings, but as Rizwan goes on to point out later in his op-ed, he says since at least World War II, pilots have been reporting strange sightings of aircraft, but last year's report focused on incidents witnessed in the past two decades. And again, let me point out, the majority of those actually involving data only collected since 2019. Rizwan says that essentially this included Navy pilots' descriptions of unidentified aerial craft that behaved in ways not from this world, in other words, in ways well beyond any known technology, in the arsenal of the United States or its top military rivals, Russia and China, each of which has its own programs to study UFOs. As he notes, Tuesday's public hearing proved as inconclusive as last year's report, partly because many answers could only be given during the classified portion of the hearing. It was revealed that one incident out of the now roughly 400 the task force is investigating had been identified as a drone, and in one of the more eyebrow-raising moments, there have been 11 near misses with unidentified objects. But more fundamentally, Rizwan drives home the following point. Viewing UAPs only through a security lens means that the military is likely to classify any findings that are truly extraordinary. He notes that Lou Elizondo, ex-head of the Pentagon's UFO Investigation Unit, has said that what the public has seen thus far is just the tip of the spear. The late Harry Reid, former Senate Majority Leader, once remarked it only scratches the surface. Yet the witnesses Tuesday indicated many details would only be disclosed in the classified portion of the hearing. You can see what Rizwan is essentially arguing here. And as he notes later in his op-ed, the real problem with hiding the best data about UFOs in some secret corner of the Pentagon is that we won't be able to lay the basic scientific foundation needed. Yeah, a public scientific foundation. Science, he says, relies on the publishing of data and theories based on that data that can be analyzed, debated, and verified by multiple groups of scientists building on each other's work. And so that does remain somewhat absent in the current UAP debate, as long as most of the information collected on these objects remains in the hands of the military. Not to say they shouldn't, but I'd really like scientists to be able to have a look at this stuff too. All right, we will continue our coverage of the UAP hearings last Tuesday when we return here in a moment, right here on the Micah Hanks program. Welcome back. Historic hearings on the UAP subject, divided opinions, lots of perspectives, and of course, we're going to get into some sound bites here in a moment from those hearings. Lots to discuss. First, I do, of course, want to remind you to head on over to MicahHanks.com/podcast. That's where you can find all the back episodes of this program. You got a lot of listening to catch up if you're one of the new listeners. Many more each and every day finding their way here. And, of course, there are a few of you who have gone even deeper in your deep dives and have found your way over to the X subscribers area. If you head over to the aforementioned link, which we also have linked there in the show notes each week, MicahHanks.com/podcast, you'll see in the upper right-hand corner where you can become an X subscriber. And as an X subscriber, you get one weekly additional podcast. You also have a monthly special that you'll be receiving all on your own unique RSS feed, and that's just $7 a month, so definitely check that out. Now, getting into our coverage of what actually happened during the hearing, we've gotten a lot of different responses from different people, some in government, many in the media, but really, what were they all talking about? What has been what has kept people talking about this for days, and what, in my opinion and likelihood, is going to keep people talking for some time to come? I think that it's pretty evident the historic nature of what we observed the other day up there on Capitol Hill, but I think we're also going to probably continue to hear about this. Much will be written about this. There are going to be books, there are going to be articles, maybe even films that touch on congressional interest that has been seen in recent days about this topic. And so for this portion of the program, we're going to head to the audio. Before we get into actual quotes from members of Congress and, of course, Mr. Ronald Moultrie and Scott Bray in their responses to those representatives, we were actually doing live coverage early in the morning, the day of the hearings, because initially they had been scheduled for 10 a.m., then they were moved up to 9 a.m., and so that meant that Race Hobbs and I, who had scheduled live coverage of the event beginning 1 hour before the hearings, had to get up extra early in our Tuesday morning coverage in advance of the event, and then, of course, with a panel discussion that followed thereafter. Here's a little bit of what Race and I had to say Tuesday morning in anticipation of what was about to unfold.
When this all first come about and all this, you know, because there's been behind the scenes, there's been an awful lot of talk about, you know, there's something working, you know, there's something in the works and there's wheels are turning. And also all too often when this chatter is in the background, let's say, you know, some things pop up and actually, you know, come to fruition. But most of the time it's like, no, it didn't. Well, it didn't work out. It didn't pan out. You know, we're going to try another route or whatever, you know, things it's just not the right time or whatever the case may be. And I kind of felt like, you know, I've been hearing things for months behind the scenes, and I've had friends that have made trips to Capitol Hill and colleagues and, you know, let's just say it. They're up there talking to lawmakers. They're up there briefing people on Capitol Hill about the subject. These guys are, you know, real contactees, let's say, people who have been exposed firsthand to real events with credibility, with credentials, and with a large amount of evidence to back it up and witness statements to back them up. So they sit down to our lawmakers and our political officials, and the chatter continues in the background. And then all of a sudden, bang, we get this announcement that they're going to do it. They're going to have hearings for the first time in 50 years. Micah, could we be making history today?
I believe that would be an understatement, my friend. And, you know, I mean, the long-standing question of, you know, are there objects in our airspace which currently our military can't identify? The scientific community maybe hasn't in years past put as much attention toward this issue, but those who have said, you know, we can't identify these either. Indeed, this is perhaps a very necessary first step with regard to trying to overcome some of the attitudes that have been projected toward this topic. If we look back in history, again, you know, I'm a history person, but I also love the history of science. And if we look at the history of science, I mean, as recently as the 19th century, there would have been, some of the most storied names in academia laughing at you if you proposed that stones could actually fall from the sky.
That's true.
If you said that there were invisible organisms, not really invisible, but just so small that the human eye couldn't perceive them, and that they could be all over your hands, and that they could actually spread diseases. Again, the most learned individuals in the history of science at various times throughout history, yet again, would have mocked you. They would have scorned you. The classic examples, of course, you know, those who in the name of science and who putting forward what at the time were controversial ideas and sometimes also meeting an untimely death at the hands of authorities who were, you know, too fearful, I think it's fair to say, of what the implications of these scientific realities might be. This has been a part of the history of science time and time and time again. And we have to ask ourselves in the here and now, as enlightened a society as we think we are, how sure are we that we have unraveled really all the mysteries of the universe? And are we prepared to accept that indeed there may still be right under our noses a few significant discoveries? That is at least the possibility that this discussion affords us. And so again, I hope that as far as lawmakers participating in this and actively playing a role in bringing attention to this, again, I couldn't imagine a more significant way that this could be done on Capitol Hill than to hold open congressional hearings before a House panel, as we're going to see here within the hour. This hopefully will be a necessary first step in changing the cultural attitude and addressing a problem, which, again, I do think, as the history of science has shown us before, will one day be recognized as yet another milestone in the not only discovery of phenomena in the universe and maybe even answers to certain lingering questions we have about what it means to be alive, what it means to be human. But this is going to also be, you know, one of those kind of breadcrumbs on the path that leads us home to a better understanding of what it means to be human, who we are, and what role we play here on this planet. Naturally, Race and I had a lot of questions. Always great to be able to get behind the mic with the legendary Habbo and to be able to offer some insights on this. But of course, shortly after we concluded our hour-long pre-game commentary, things began to take shape as Andre Carson led off with opening statements. And actually, I want to feature a quick soundbite here also from the opening statements that were given by Ronald Moultrie, which kind of outline exactly what the military's current level of involvement is.
It's a privilege to be here with you today to address your questions regarding unidentified aerial phenomenon, or UAP. What are UAP? Put simply, UAP are airborne objects that, when encountered, cannot be immediately identified. However, it is the department's contention that by combining appropriately structured, collected data with rigorous scientific analysis, any object that we encounter can likely be isolated, characterized, identified, and if necessary, mitigated. With regard to the importance of transparency, the department is fully committed to the principle of openness and accountability to the American people. However, we are also mindful of our obligation to protect sensitive sources and methods. Our goal is to strike that delicate balance, one that enables us to maintain the public's trust while preserving those capabilities that are vital to the support of our service personnel. In closing, the department is committed to this effort and welcomes the challenge. We thank you for your committed support and look forward to your questions.
Scott Bray, also speaking during those opening statements, kind of addressed the challenges right now that military officials are facing in terms of collecting data about UAP. I want to go to a soundbite from Bray talking about that, which really gives us an idea of some of the hurdles that the UAP Task Force and its current efforts have faced.
As we detailed in both the unclassified and classified versions of the preliminary assessment released by the Office of the Director of National Intelligence last June, this often limited amount of high-quality data and reporting hampers our ability to draw firm conclusions about the nature or intent of UAP. As detailed in the ODNI report, if and when individual UAP incidents are resolved, they likely fall into one of five potential explanatory categories: airborne clutter, natural atmospheric phenomena, U.S. government or U.S. industry developmental programs, foreign adversary systems, or a other bin that allows for a holding bin of difficult cases and for the possibility of surprise and potential scientific discovery.
And now getting to those questions from the representatives themselves, many of whom had very interesting points that they wanted to address with Mr. Moultrie and Mr. Bray. Adam Schiff actually had one of the most notable early questions where he began to ask about propulsion or any evidence of it that has been observed during UAP sightings collected by the military. We now have that audio.
Of those 144, 18 of them reportedly appear to exhibit unusual flight characteristics, appear to demonstrate advanced technology, and some of them appeared to remain stationary in winds aloft, move against the wind, maneuver abruptly, or move at considerable speed without discernible means of propulsion. That's pretty intriguing. And if you're able to answer this in this setting, are we aware of any foreign adversary capable of moving objects without any discernible means of propulsion?
I think I would, without discernible means of propulsion, I would say that we're not aware of any adversary that can move an object without discernible means of propulsion. The question then becomes, in many of these cases where we don't have a discernible mean of propulsion in the data that we have, in some cases there is likely sensor artifacts that may be hiding some of that. There's certainly some degree of something that looks like signature management that we have seen from some of these UAP. But I would caution, I would simply say that there are a number of events in which we do not have an explanation, in which, and there are a small handful in which there are flight characteristics or signature management that we can't explain with the data that we have. We'll continue. Those are obviously the ones that are of most interest to us. Earlier, when we asked about how you avoid technological surprise, the biggest way you avoid technological surprise is by collecting this type of data and by importantly calibrating the assumptions that you go into with how you do that analysis. I'll tell you, within the UAP Task Force, we have one basic assumption, and that is that generally speaking, our sensors operate as designed. And we make that assumption because many times these are multi-sensor collections. We make no assumptions about the origin of this or that there may or may not be some sort of technology that we don't understand. That's, I think, the key to avoiding technological surprises, by calibrating those assumptions.
I like the way that Bray says that, calibrating those assumptions so that we can better avoid technological surprise. But essentially, he says, in order to calibrate the way that we interpret this so that we avoid technological surprise, we make no assumptions about what we're observing. We're just trying to collect data right now. I also want to go to the audio soundbite now from Representative Gallagher that got so much attention in the media that we heard about, where he's talking about Malmstrom Air Force Base and what happened there in 1967.
It's also been reported that there have been UAP observed and interacting with and flying over sensitive military facilities, particularly, and not just ranges, but some facilities housing our strategic nuclear forces. One such incident allegedly occurred at Malmstrom Air Force Base, in which 10 of our nuclear ICBMs were rendered inoperable. At the same time, a glowing red orb was observed overhead. I'm not commenting on the accuracy of this. I'm simply asking you whether you're aware of it and whether you have any comment on the accuracy of that report.
Let me pass that to Mr. Bray. You've been looking at the UAPs over the last 3 years.
That data is not within the holdings of the UAP Task Force.
Okay. But are you aware of the report? or that the data exists somewhere?
I have heard stories. I have not seen the official data on that.
So you've just seen informal stories, no official assessment that you've done or exists within DOD that you're aware of regarding the Malmstrom incident?
All I can speak to is, you know, what's within my cognizance of the UAP task force, and we have not looked at that incident.
Well, I would say, I mean, it's a pretty high-profile incident. I don't claim to be an expert on this, but that's out there in the ether. You're the guys investigating it. I mean, who else is doing it?
If something was officially brought to our attention, we would look at it. There are many things that are out there in the ether that aren't officially brought to our attention.
So how would it have to be officially brought to your attention? I'm bringing it to your attention.
Sure, so.
This is pretty official.
Sure. So we'll go back and take a look at it. But generally, there is some authoritative figure that says there is an incident that occurred. We'd like you to look at this. But in terms of just tracking what may be in the media that says that something occurred at this time, at this place, there are probably a lot of leads that we would have to follow up on. I don't think we are resourced to do that right now.
Well, I don't claim to be an authoritative figure, but for what it's worth, I would like you to look into it.
And sure.
If for no other reason, you could dismiss it and say this is not worth wasting resources on.
We'll do.
Now, Gallagher's primary line of questioning right there, you know, was this incident looked at by the current UAP efforts within the DOD? I don't think that's unreasonable. But then, of course, in the other portion of the audio, and we're going to come back around and talk more about this later, but he also asked Moultrie and Bray about the famous Admiral Wilson memo. Let's not get into that now. We'll save that for a little bit later. Another audio soundbite I want to feature, however, involves, and this was one that really stood out to Tim McMillan, Representative Krishnamurti, asking about communication with UAP, possible recovery of crashes. This line of questioning obviously drew from existing information about this subject. Tim actually found this very interesting, and he went into depth about this during the Twitter spaces that he and I did over the weekend for the debrief. But I want to feature this audio soundbite of Krishnamurti's question and also the responses to ideas about communication by military officials with UAP and other interesting topics, no less among them the idea of crash wreckage retrievals.
Have we attempted to communicate with those objects?
No.
So we don't even put out a alert saying, you know, U.S. Identify yourself. You are, you know, within our flight path or something like that. We haven't said anything like that.
We've not put anything out like that. Generally speaking, for example, in the video that we showed earlier, it appears to be something that is, unmanned, appears to be something that may or may not be in controlled flight. And so we've not attempted any communication with that.
Okay. So, and I assume we've never discharged any armaments against a UAP, correct?
That's correct.
How about wreckage? Have we come across any wreckage of any kind of object that has now been examined by you?
The UAP task force doesn't have any wreckage that isn't explainable, that isn't consistent with being of terrestrial origin.
Do we have any sensors underwater to detect on submerged UAPs? Anything that is in the ocean or in the seas?
So I think that would be more appropriately addressed in closed session, sir.
Okay. Basically, it sounds like we have a good partnership with FAA, but apart from FAA, we don't have partnerships with other agencies or other entities that might be tracking so that we could enlarge our data set to make comparisons.
But we will. So that's the goal of this next effort, will be to expand that relationship with the rest of government and the interagency.
Now, is it just me, by the way, or at times, especially does Mr. Moultrie seem a little uncomfortable with some of these questions? Although, generally speaking, I thought for the open portion of the hearing that both Moultrie and Bray were very forthcoming. They seemed to the best of their ability, answer every one of the questions that were asked by the representatives in attendance. But to me, the whole thing about communicating with UAP seems very logical. You know, let me break this down in reference to past shows we've done where we've kind of touched on this subject. You know, naturally, one that comes to mind was the identification friend or foe episode we did a few weeks back, where we looked at instances where unusual aircraft or unidentified flying objects, for lack of a better term, back during the Blue Book years, were queried by U.S. Air Force personnel using IFF friend or foe systems, and the unidentified object actually appears to have responded in the affirmative, friend. Which means one of two things. This is an aircraft that was built by us using the same sort of system and capable of responding on that encrypted channel, or it's some kind of advanced technology that can emulate that response, and thereby it's capable of intercepting our encrypted communication systems. Those to me are really the only explanations. One of them might seem more likely than the other. To me, again, this does strongly point to the idea that some unidentified flying objects, when they have issued such a response through IFF queries, you know, they're probably ours. And hence, you know, this does get into the area of black budget programs, secret aerospace developments, special access programs, things like this. That going all the way back to the Blue Book days. And it's a really interesting question, especially if we still haven't gotten clarification on what those aircraft were after all this time. How long have some of these aerospace developments remained secret? Very important question. But the short answer to Krishnamurti's question, you know, have we ever attempted to communicate with these things? Well, yeah, if we go back in time, if we look at the history of this phenomena, that absolutely has occurred. But there haven't been instances in the current data collected by the Navy's UAP Task Force. Again, it'd be hard to do that with just 400 reports collected since 2019. Briefly on that point, 400 incidents since at least as recently as 2019, possibly all the way back to 2004. That's quite a lot of incidents. It seems that the military encounters UAP pretty frequently, doesn't it? But in this next question, and this one offered by Representative Himes, he asks more fundamentally, look, you know, when we're talking about unidentified aerial phenomena and unexplained incidents, what does that really mean? You know, what can you say in this open portion of the hearing in terms of what you mean when you say some of these things are unidentified? What does that mean? What are unexplained about these incidents? We have that audio.
When you say we can't explain, give the public a little bit better sense of where on that spectrum of we can't explain we are. Are we holding materials, organic or inorganic, that we don't know about? Are we, you know, picking up emanations that are something other than light or infrared that could be deemed to be communications? Give us a sense for what you mean when you say we can't explain.
Sure. When I say we can't explain, I mean exactly as you described there, that there is a lot of information, like the video that we showed, in which there's simply too little data to create a reasonable explanation. There are a small handful of cases in which we have more data that our analysis simply hasn't been able to fully pull together a picture of what happened. And those are the cases where we talk about where we see some indications of flight characteristics or signature management that are not what we had expected. When it comes to material that we have no material. We have detected no emanations within the UAP task force that would suggest it's anything non-terrestrial in origin. So there's, when I say unexplained, I mean everything from too little data to we simply, the data that we have doesn't point us towards an explanation, but we'll go wherever the data takes us. Again, we've made no assumptions about what this is or isn't. We're committed to understanding these, and so we'll go wherever that data takes us.
One more soundbite here before we go to the break. I also want to feature a quick clip of Scott Bray addressing the challenges to the collection of data, and of course, making as much available to the public as possible, but also doing so in a way that doesn't conflict with protecting necessary national security interests. In other words, the idea of necessary secrecy when it comes to collection of data about UAP.
This is a popular topic in our nation, with various theories as to what these objects may be and where they originate. By nature, we are all curious and we seek to understand the unknown. And as a lifelong intelligence professional, I'm impatient. I want immediate explanations for this as much as anyone else. However, understanding can take significant time and effort. It's why we've endeavored to concentrate on this data-driven process to drive fact-based results. And given the nature of our business, national defense, we've had to sometimes be less forthcoming with information in open forums than many would hope. If UAP do indeed represent a potential threat to our security, then the capabilities, systems, processes, and sources we use to observe, record, study, or analyze these phenomena need to be classified at appropriate levels. We do not want potential adversaries to know exactly what we're able to see or understand, or how we come to the conclusions we make. Therefore,
public disclosures must be carefully considered on a case-by-case basis. So what's next? We're concentrating on a seamless transition to the new organization. And future analysis of complicated issues of UAP issues will greatly benefit from the infrastructure, the process, and the procedures that we've developed to date. I'm confident that the task force under Navy leadership has forged a path forward that will allow us to anchor assessments in science and engineering via anecdotal evidence. We remain committed to that goal, as I know the USDI organization does as well. So thank you very much for your interest and continuing support for the UAP task force. The team's made a lot of progress, but we really are just establishing the foundation for the more detailed analysis that's yet to be done. And with your continued support, we can sustain that momentum necessary to produce data-centric analysis and understanding of the phenomena.
So that essentially is, in short form, a summary of what happened at the hearing the other day. Now, when we come back, as we're wrapping things up, I want to also look at a few surprises that came up during this hearing. As I mentioned, we'll have a little more to say about that Admiral Wilson memo, that ever-controversial topic. Also, the one case that they say really continues to baffle the Navy as far as UAP, that and much more as we wrap up here on the Micah Hanks Program. Wrapping up this week's dispatch on the Micah Hanks Program. Ex-subscribers, of course, don't forget that we'll have additional commentary, and we'll be looking at another famous case this week that I've been recently revisiting. I'll tell you all about what I found on the X podcast this week. But as we're wrapping up our coverage about what unfolded up there on Capitol Hill in recent days, I also want to talk about some of the things that really stood out to me. The surprises, if you will. And in fact, I wrote about this a bit in this week's Intelligence Brief newsletter for the debrief. You might as well jump right into things. Here are four of the big takeaways for me. Well, you know, more than takeaways, again, these were surprising points that came up during the hearings. So call them what you will, but these are a few things that stood out to me, for lack of any other better way to describe it. The first one, apparently there's a database where these UAP sightings, after they are collected, are being held. At one point during the hearings, Deputy Director of Naval Intelligence Scott Bray not only mentioned the current efforts to collect data on UAP, but I want to quote him here. He said, as detailed in the ODNI report, if and when individual UAP incidents are resolved, they likely fall into one of five potential explanatory categories. He names those, again, for those who may not remember. Those are airborne clutter, natural atmospheric phenomena, U.S. government or U.S. industry developmental programs, or an adversary system, or an other bin that allows for a holding bin of difficult cases and for the possibility of surprise and potential scientific discovery. But he also notes, we stand by those initial results. Since the release of that preliminary report, UAP Task Force database has now grown to contain approximately 400 reports, and the stigma has been reduced. So he says, database. Now, again, he may just be essentially saying, well, you know, these are the reports we've collected, but presumably, if they're collecting them, if there's data that's being analyzed, he's not kidding. He's not just equivocating when he says our database has grown. I mean, obviously, the UAP task force keeps a database. Here's a question. Is that something that's FOIA-able? Could we file a Freedom of Information Act request for that data? You know, one interpretation here might be that it would be a good idea to do that before that data carries over to the AIMSOG, just because once it does, you know, this is officially a DOD program. But, you know, there's already some language in the NDAA that was passed involving the Gillibrand Amendment that is working in the furtherance of making sure that there is transparency on these issues. And that was a point that was actually emphasized during the hearings the other day. Another point, by the way, that stuck out to me had to do with the fact that the AIMSOG, they're trying to make it pronounceable, but it's still not a memorable name. Well, good news, ladies and gents. that probably won't continue to be the name of the new DoD UAP program. As Moultrie stated at one point, while referencing the Ames SOG, he said, "I believe the name will likely change." Let's hope so. But what might they call it? Is it too much to hope that they'll just go back to what Senator Gillibrand's amendment originally asked to call it, the ASRO, Anomaly Surveillance and Resolution Office? Then there was another version of the bill drafted where they added a T so they could just call it ASTRO. That's kind of a cool name, right? I mean, I'd be okay with that one, but I guess we'll have to wait and see what they ultimately decide they want to call it. Here's another big thing that really stood out to me as far as questions asked by the representatives of Mr. Bray and Mr. Moultrie. At one point, Representative Rick Crawford essentially asked if there were any specific examples that the two military witnesses could give as far as an object that can't be explained as having been human-made or natural. And Bray was very careful with his answer. In fact, I want to go to the audio soundbite for this one, where he attempted to say to Representative Crawford, you know, "I can't point to anything that is indisputably of exotic origin. We can't rule out something man-made," but he says there is one case, of course, that remains in our data set that really is kind of, I mean, the go-to as far as a really weird UAP case. In fact, you might have heard of this one. Here's what Mr. Bray had to say.
If you'll indulge me, I just have one, a couple of real small questions. One is, do we have an example? Can you cite a specific example of an object that can't be explained as having been human-made or natural?
I mean, the example that I would say that is still unresolved, that I think everyone understands quite well, is the 2004 incident from Nimitz. We have data on that, and it simply remains unresolved. Does not mean it resolves to being something, right, that is easily explainable or difficulty. Or, well, obviously it resolves to being something that is difficult to explain. Mm-hmm. But I can't point to something that definitively was not man-made, but I can point to a number of examples in which remain unresolved.
So that's interesting that, of course, the Nimitz incident is still cited by Bray as being, you know, one of those kind of landmark cases, but that he adds there at the end that he can point to a number of cases currently in the database, I guess, that's what he calls it at least, of the Navy's UAP task force that they say can't be identified. So I found that kind of interesting. But as promised, as we're wrapping up here, I also want to touch briefly on the statements by Representative Mike Gallagher involving the Wilson memo. During the hearing, Gallagher directed this question at Ronald Moultrie, asking, "Are you aware of a document that appeared around 2019, sometimes called the Admiral Wilson Memo or EW Notes Memo?" To which Moultrie, of course, said, "No, I'm not. I'm not personally aware of that." Gallagher, then giving a brief summary of this document, added, "I'm not commenting on the veracity, but," he says, "I was hoping you could help me with this, in which the former head of DIA claims to have had a conversation with the doctor, Eric Davis. Davis claims to have sort of been made aware of certain contractors or DOD programs that he tried to get full access to and was denied access to." So Moultrie then says, "I'm not aware of that, Congressman." But there were additional questions that came up later involving whether there were any programs like this that either Moultrie or Bray might have known about involving secret efforts to study, to unravel, maybe even reproduce UAP kind of technologies. Neither of them said, at least in the public portion of the hearing, that they were familiar with any kinds of efforts like this, any kinds of secret programs. But then again, if they are secret special access programs, it's very unlikely, first of all, that either of them would necessarily know about it, and they sure aren't going to be talking about it in an unclassified portion of a hearing. Now, that said, there have been others who have weighed in on the Wilson memo in recent years. Notable among them, longtime UFO commentator Billy Cox, who writes for the Herald Tribune, has maintained what some characterize as the long-standing and only mainstream media blog about UFOs. I think he's also now operating on Substack as well. But back in 2019, Cox interviewed Thomas Wilson about that memo. And at that time, apparently, Admiral Thomas Wilson said, "I wouldn't know Eric Davis if he walked in right now." Also, at the probing of journalist Ross Coulthart, apparently the former DIA chief, Admiral Wilson, told Ross that memo is fiction. But something else that Ross points out in his book, In Plain Sight, and we got to get Ross on the program at some point. He and I have been in touch, but of course he's got his own podcast he's producing these days with Bryce Sable. Definitely be sure and check out Ross and Bryce's efforts together. But Ross notes, you know, in the actual memorandum at one point, Admiral Wilson essentially says, you know, what do you intend to do with this, this memo? Because essentially there was a recording being made and the memo is supposedly a transcript of that. And Wilson says, you know, if you ever come out and say that we had this conversation, I'll just deny it. So if it's true, any of what's contained in that memo, I mean, Admiral Wilson told us then, I'll just deny this, and that's certainly what he's done. But that was certainly, without question, one of the more surprising points to come up during the hearings on Tuesday. Now, of course, as I pointed out, a lot of different opinions have been aired. We've already heard some of the feedback from those in Washington, also people in the mainstream media. Right now, I actually want to feature a couple of final sound bites, and this coming from Stephen Bassett, head of the Paradigm Research Group. You know, Steve Bassett is very much, and always has been, all in on the UFOs are unequivocally extraterrestrial technologies bandwagon. That's always been his main thrust. But I think we also have to really acknowledge that, for the longest time, Steve Bassett has been the only full-time UFO lobbyist in Washington. And I was certainly interested in seeing how Steve would receive these hearings, what he would have to say about them. Shortly after the hearings, Steve jumped on the microphone with Race Hobbs for the live UNEX coverage of the hearings, and he had some very interesting insights he wanted to add about what this all means and really what it means to him, having been a lobbyist. You know, he's got his own ideas about UFOs and how to approach this subject, but really being someone who has been a part of this effort up there in Washington for years, he certainly had some interesting takeaways, as you'll hear in the following audio soundbite.
Now, here are the most important things, as far as I'm concerned. And Andre Carson clearly is on the case here. You can tell he's only just getting started. Two, Adam Schiff didn't have to show up for this, but he did. He is, of course, the Intel committee chair, the big guy. He showed up. He made a number of statements, and he made it clear that, that there's going to be more coming here. And I think he's pretty much set the stage for him to now call hearings for the Senate House Intel Committee, which is a whole different ballgame. Those hearings are going to start, the next hearings are going to start bringing in the witnesses that we want, such as John Burroughs and other witnesses to nuclear weapons tampering and so forth. But you got to walk before you can run. And then there was our good friend Mike Gallagher, a Republican, young, dynamic, intelligent. He was either tasked to, or he made the decision to, okay, look, I'm going to create a little heat here. I'm not going to let this hearing just go by and be too vanilla. So, and most of just regular citizens or regular journalists that were watching this probably did not understand the significance of what Gallagher did. But he put the Wilson Davis notes into play. These are pretty significant things, those notes. Controversial, heavily, intensely debated in our field, but not resolved, I can assure you. And the implications of those notes, when they're looked at further, if they get looked at in the congressional setting, are non-trivial and could possibly lead to Admiral Wilson and Davis having to come in and perhaps testify. So he did that. He also brought up, well, John, what was the other thing that he brought up? He brought up the nuclear incident.
Maelstrom, right. Can I say something about the Davis exchange?
Of course.
Here's the problem, Steve, that here's the fine line I have, okay? And I was in the military. I understand national security, and I'm not against it. But, okay, let's say he introduced them to the record for a reason, and they're going to force them to come in. It'll probably happen behind closed doors.
Let's put it this way. Generally speaking, the last 75 years has been behind closed doors.
Right.
Whatever the government does on this issue is behind closed doors. What has, of course, happened is because of what's taken place since 2017 is that we're now in a different place. And now there is going to be the front open door hearings. In other words, there's always going to be the classified. But they've now said, look, enough is enough. It's been 54 years. We know how much interest the public has. We know the evidence is pouring out. We know all of these things. We're seeing the thousands of articles that are being written about this in greater depth. We're fully aware of the Nimitz case. We're aware of the efforts by Mellon and Elizondo, et cetera, et cetera. And it's okay now. We want the public to start seeing this take place.
Stephen Bassett right there, the Paradigm Research Group. Also, John Burroughs, who was one of the participants in the famous Rendlesham Forest UFO event from back in 1980. You know, no matter what you believe about UAP, I think really that a lot of Bassett's perspectives are accurate, that, you know, generally the public wants to know about this. There is tremendous interest. We're finally seeing lawmakers now saying, you know, we are going to move toward trying to bring broader attention to it, but also to ensure transparency on part of government studies in terms of what they're willing to communicate about what they study to the American people as we go forward. And of course, I think that's very important. One more quick soundbite, by the way, I just want to throw in here right here at the very end from Steve Bassett during his conversation with Race Hobbs.
By the way, Tim McMillan and Micah Hanks are doing an absolutely incredible job, worthy of any of the major papers in the country, frankly, or maybe even better in some respects.
A very nice endorsement from Stephen Bassett. Thanks for that. I appreciate that. And of course, he's referencing the work that Tim and I do over there at thedebrief.org. You can follow us online there at the site. And of course, you can follow me online at MicahHanks.com. But that just about wraps up our coverage of these hearings. My final take on it is essentially this. No matter what your perspectives on UAP are, I think that this will be recognized as a historic time. These are indeed historic developments. And I think that maybe for those who have long been involved in this UAP debate and who have looked at it and asked questions about it and wondered what it might mean for all of us, indeed, maybe we are beginning to see some significant traction, and we're finally also beginning to see some significant effort on part of lawmakers in terms of moving toward understanding this, understanding what government agencies know about it, and also trying to move toward bringing transparency into the equation. To me, that's all very important. And these hearings are a necessary step in that direction. And hence, yes, they are historic. So, that's my take. Thanks to all of you for being here and being a part of the program this week. You can follow me over there at MicahHanks.com, as I mentioned, and on Twitter at MicahHanks. I'll catch you guys next time. And as always, stay strange out there. We'll talk to you again soon.